A team of British scientists led by the German-born Rudolf E. Peierls arrived in Los Alamos.
Oppenheimer had first met this brilliant but unassuming theoretical physicist in 1929, when both men were studying under Wolfgang Pauli.
Peierls had emigrated from Germany to England in the early 1930s, and in 1940, he and Otto R. Frisch had written the seminal paper
On the Construction of a Superbomb, which had persuaded both the British and American governments that a nuclear weapon was feasible.
During the next several years, Peierls worked on all aspects of tube alloys, the British bomb program. In 1942, and again in September 1943, Prime Minister Winston Churchill sent Peierls to America to help expedite work on the bomb. Peierls visited Oppenheimer in Berkeley and was very impressed with his command of things.
He was the first person I met on that trip who had thought about the weapon itself and the implications of the physics of what would be going on.
Dr. Peierls spent only 2.5 days on his first visit to Los Alamos.
But Oppenheimer reported to Groves that they had agreed the British team could contribute substantially to studying the hydrodynamics of implosion.
A month later, Peierls moved back to Los Alamos for the duration of the war.
He admired how articulate and quick Oppenheimer was to understand anyone, but he particularly admired the way he could stand up to General Groves.
As Peierls and his team settled into Los Alamos in the spring of 1944, Oppenheimer decided to give Peierls the job ostensibly held by Edward Teller.
The mercurial Hungarian physicist was supposed to be working on a complicated set of calculations necessary for the implosion bomb. But Teller wasn't performing. Obsessed with the theoretical challenges posed by a super thermonuclear bomb, Teller had no interest in a fission bomb. After Oppenheimer decided in June 1943 that wartime exigencies dictated a low priority for the super, Teller became increasingly uncooperative. He seemed oblivious to any responsibility to contribute to the war effort. Always loquacious, he talked incessantly about a hydrogen bomb. Neither could he contain his resentment at having to work under Beta. "I was not happy about having him as my boss," Teller recalled. To be sure, his resentment was fueled by Beta's criticisms. Every morning, Teller would have a bright new idea about how to make an H-bomb work, and overnight, Beta would prove it cockeyed. After one particularly trying encounter with Teller, Oppie quipped to Charles Critchfield, "God protect us from the enemy without and the Hungarians within." Oppenheimer, understandably, became increasingly annoyed by Teller's behavior. One day that spring, Teller walked out of a meeting of section leaders and refused to do some calculations Beta needed for his work on the implosion project. Extremely angry, Beta complained to Oppie. "Edward essentially went on strike," Beta recalled. When Oppenheimer confronted him about the incident, Teller finally asked to be relieved of all responsibility for work on the fission bomb. Oppenheimer agreed and wrote General Groves that he wished to replace Teller with Peierls. These calculations were originally under the supervision of Teller, who is, in my opinion and Beta's, quite unsuited for this responsibility. Beta feels that he needs a man under him to handle the implosion program. Feeling slighted, Teller let it be known that he was thinking of leaving Los Alamos altogether. No one would have been surprised if Oppenheimer had let him go. Everyone thought of Teller as a prima donna. Bob Serber called him a disaster to any organization. But instead of firing him, Oppenheimer gave Teller what he wanted: freedom to explore the feasibility of a thermonuclear bomb. Oppenheimer even agreed to give him a precious hour of his time once a week just to talk about whatever was on Teller's mind. Not even this extraordinary gesture satisfied Teller, who thought his friend had become a politician. Oppie's colleagues wondered why he bothered with Teller. Peierls considered Teller somewhat wild. He can back an idea for a time, and then it turns out to be nonsense. Oppenheimer could be impatient with fools, but he was aware that Teller was no fool. He tolerated him because, in the end, he might contribute something to the project. When, later that summer, he hosted a reception for Churchill's special representative, Lord Cherwell, Frederick A. Lindemann, Oppenheimer realized afterwards that he had inadvertently left Rudolf Peierls off the invitation list. The next day he apologized to Peierls and then quipped, "It could have been worse. It could have been Teller." In December 1944, Oppenheimer urged Robbie to make another visit to Los Alamos. "Dear Rob," he wrote, We have been wondering for some time when you could come out again. The crises here are so continuous that it is hard to find one time which would be better or worse than another from our point of view. Rabi had just been awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in recognition for his resonance method for recording the magnetic properties of atomic nuclei. Oppie congratulated him. It is nice to have the prize go to a man who is out of his adolescence rather than just entering it. Swamped with administrative work, Oppenheimer still found time to write the occasional personal letter. In the spring of 1944, he wrote to a family of German refugees whose escape from Europe he had facilitated. They were utter strangers, but in 1940 he had given the Myers family, a mother and four daughters, a sum of money to pay their expenses to the United States. 4 years later, the Myers repaid Oppenheimer and proudly informed him that they had become American citizens. He wrote back that he understood the pride they felt, and he thanked them for the money. "I hope it has not been a hardship for you." He then offered to return the money if they had any further need for it. Years later, one of the Myers daughters wrote in gratitude, "In 1940 you brought us all over and we could save our lives." For Oppenheimer, the rescue of the Myerses from the Nazi contagion was important in several respects. It was in the first instance a politically non-controversial extension of his anti-fascist activism, and that felt good. Secondly, while a small act of generosity, it was nevertheless a profound and welcome reminder of why he was racing to build a horrific weapon. And racing he was. Restlessness was part of his character, or so thought Freeman Dyson, a young physicist who came to know and admire Oppenheimer after the war. But Dyson also saw restlessness as Oppie's tragic flaw. Restlessness drove him to his supreme achievement, the fulfillment of the mission of Los Alamos, without pause for rest or reflection. "Only one man paused," Dyson wrote. "The one who paused was Joseph Rotblat from Liverpool." A Polish physicist, Rotblat had been stranded in England when the war broke out. He was recruited by James Chadwick into the British bomb project and by early 1944 found himself in Los Alamos. One evening in March 1944, Rotblat experienced a disagreeable shock. General Groves came for dinner at the Chadwicks, and in the course of casual banter over the dinner table, he said, "You realize, of course, that the main purpose of this project is to subdue the Russians." Rotblat was shocked. He had no illusions about Stalin. The Soviet dictator had, after all, invaded his beloved Poland. But thousands of Russians were dying every day on the Eastern Front, and Rotblat felt a sense of betrayal. "Until then, I had thought that our work was to prevent a Nazi victory," he later wrote. "And now I was told that the weapon we were preparing was intended for use against the people who were making extreme sacrifices for that very aim." By the end of 1944, 6 months after the Allies had landed on the beaches of Normandy, it was clear that the war in Europe would soon be over. Rotblat saw no point in continuing to work on a weapon that was no longer needed to defeat the Germans. After saying goodbye to Oppenheimer at a going-away party, he left Los Alamos on December 8, 1944.